to Troublesome Terps, the podcast that keeps interpreters up at night. And we've also heard from our listeners the podcast that's great to listen to while you're in the gym. Although I wouldn't suggest being in the gym for the entire podcast because that might tire you out. With me in our slimmed down, cut down virtual studio today, it's great to welcome back yet again, Alexander Gansmeyer.
It's a pleasure to be here. And the whole slim down, cut down, that reminds me of what I need to do because lockdown has not been kind. But the gyms are still closed, so I can't even listen to our podcast in those. So, you know.
I've been running 5-6Ks. It's nice. Anyway,
I've been doing physiotherapy. I wish I could.
Physiotherapy. Physios, they like medieval torturers, only paid better. So we have a wonderful guest with us this evening or this morning, whenever you're listening to this. We have with us Killian Sabre. Killian heads up the interpreting department at the University of Geneva's FTI. He has formal training in conference interpreting and psycholinguistics. He's probably best known, and I would say he's probably one of the world's experts on cognitive processes in interpreting, including cognitive load and multimodal integration. And if you've crossed paths with Killian at conferences, and I must say that I have, you probably know him as the guy who likes to ask uncomfortable questions. And the first time I met Killian was at IPCity in probably Manchester, I think. And you could rely on Killian to ask the questions that made the presenters go, "Oh, I have to think now." So, Killian, welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me. I did not remember that.
I'm pretty sure. Was it Manchester or Edinburgh, IPCity, that you were
at? I thought it was Vienna we met first. But that must have been much later.
Honestly, because I remember you being in one of the plenary speakers at IPCity one year. And my colleague, Marwa Shami, admitting that she was trying to understand the cognitive stuff.
She said, "This guy just totally confused me. So let's get rid of him."
Those are her exact words. You remember that?
Yep. That's happened before.
But the thing is, though, is we're going to get into this in a moment. Cognition was the kind of core part of interpreting studies for a long time in its history. So what's your history with the cognitive side of interpreting? What got you into interpreting and into interpreting research and especially cognition, I guess?
Well, it was the beginnings, wasn't it? But I'm going to be that guy who's going to draw your attention to the fact that you just gave me a double-barreled question, the answers to which are very different. How did it all start with interpreting? That's I gave some thought to that when I saw that this might be something you could be interested in. And I thought back to how it all started. It started out of nowhere. I had to pick a major and had no idea what I was going to pick. And I looked at the course catalog and it said biochemistry. And I was very fond of the chemistry kit and the idea of working in a lab and, you know, mixing all sorts of potions and making things explode. So I thought that's what I'm gonna major in. And then I saw something else in the catalog and it said conference interpreting and I had no clue. And some argue, I still don't. And I thought I'm going to do a double major, only to find out that was not possible logistically because courses and classes would overlap too much. And so I went for the obvious choice, which was to study the thing I had no idea about. Right? And who should be one of my trainers, if not Ingrid Kurtz, person who pioneered the work on cognition and interpreters with lateralization, so hemispheric lateralization, what happens in the left and the right part of the brain. And there was even a young assistant at the time by the name of Franz, and it turned out to be Franz Pascheka.
So there you go. Franz, you were trained by the best, I see.
And yet it didn't rub off, it seems.
What is it like to train under people who have that presence and almost aura around them? Did were you aware of it at the time?
No, I was blissfully ignorant. I was oblivious to any and all of that. So it was just they were fun to be around, very approachable, very normal people. No, I was going to say unlike others. No, just like everybody else, very approachable. They basically planted the seed. But that had nothing to do really with the research, with me getting into research, which started relatively later, not much later, once I came to Geneva. And that was in 1998 as a student, and then I soon started as a project assistant. It was basically just a matter of getting a paycheck. And if you've been to Geneva, which you have, both of you,
yes,
you know what I'm talking about. As somebody I know once put it, money talks. But here it mainly says goodbye. So I wasn't half bad at this experimental research thing. And I suppose it was a mix of just wanting to know how stuff works and being a bit of a control freak, and the two mixed well. And that was it.
I was going to say, so was your research always heading down the cognition track, or were you ever attracted by the context or wider field research and interpreting?
No, it was always the cognitive stuff. It was always the stuff that goes on in the interpreter's brain, provided you can spot it. It was with the Ascona workshops where it all began. You might be familiar with the Ascona workshop series back in the day when conferences still lasted for a full week. And it was a full week dedicated to research in a beautiful resort overlooking Lake Ascona in the Italian-speaking part of the country. And it was co-organized by FTI and UCSC. And I was a total greenhorn, only just started my what's it called? You'd call it basically an MA by research, the DEA, which they used to have in French speaking environments. Maybe they still do in France. It's a prep degree before you can do a PhD, and you learn methods and all that stuff. And I was there to do Xerox copies and to help people fill in their expense claim forms and, you know, serve
the
coffee.
Important stuff.
The important stuff. Well, right. You know, it turned out to be relatively important. It's thanks to serving coffee that I got to know Miriam, so late Miriam Schlesinger, who would then go on to become the co-editor of Interpreting with France. Jorma Tomola from Turku, who I think by now is long retired. Nelson Cowan, Charles Holm from Oxford. And I was in awe by the work of Jorma, who really pioneered this pupillometry thing, among other things, in interpreting research. And I was fascinated by the idea of measuring things psychophysiologically. So not just asking people how, you know, what did you do? How did you do it? But I'm going to measure something. And then, yeah, I went on to doing my PhD in Geneva, my postdoc in York. And there too, serendipity, I don't know, episode 5, I did my, it is a confluence of circumstances, the stars just aligned. I was working under and with Jerry Altman, who at the time was editor-in-chief of Cognition, and down the hall from my office was Alan Baddeley's office, the co-author of The Working Memory Model. So lab talks and meetings ended up being really interesting for me.
And this is the thing about research, is interpreting is still fairly small as a field, and you often go to an interpreting university and you meet people who you might not recognize how great they are at the time, but then you go away and you go, oh, that's who that is. Now, you've mentioned pupillometry, you've mentioned measuring. The elephant in the room, I guess, is what is cognition? We could kind of give it a general definition, but what's your working definition for what counts as interpreter cognition?
Yeah, if you break it down for lay people like me.
Well, cognition is obviously broad, and it's much broader than anything I could possibly do in a lifetime or two. The part of cognition that I and that we in general are interested in at the lab really has to do with process research. So perhaps the mechanics of the task. This is probably underselling it, but for lack of better definition, the way in which signals are processed in the brain, and this whole idea of you receiving stimuli through your senses, all of them somehow coming together in your brain. Now, we're interested in the mind much more than the brain. We're not doing currently much neuroscientific research here. So we really look at mind stuff rather than brain stuff. Having said that, I recently had my assistant come up, ask me if we couldn't purchase additional equipment to do just that. And like, yeah,
sure.
It's not the kind of stuff that you buy with the coins you fish out from the couch.
Got some change lying around.
Right. So that's the kind of cognition work that we've been doing, using both the old-fashioned, perhaps, or traditional behaviorist approach. So the black box approach: you have a stimulus, you don't really know what's going on in the brain, and then you have the output. But particularly also measuring psychophysiologically. So do we have other indicators that we can measure? Be it in our case, a lot of ocular responses. Where do they look? How do they look? How fast do they look? How often do they look? Which is perhaps counterintuitive for a task that people think is only about listening and talking, but also heart rate, skin conductivity. So things that you can't really control as a participant, unlike a response I give you. If you ask me, well, how was that interpretation? How difficult was it? How tired are you? I control my response, and so I filter it. Mm. Without knowing it, without wanting to. Whereas if you measure something, if you measure an indicator, well, then you get a measurement. Now, we just need to make sure, and this is not a trivial task, that you're actually measuring what you think you're measuring. And that's the crux.
And that's the thing as well. You're traditionally in the cognitive approaches to interpreting, everyone was trying to isolate variables. So, you know, we'll play at this speed and then this speed and then this speed. You've really pioneered an approach that tries to make the cognitive experiments more realistic by trying to understand how interpreters process different sources of information. What made you move from the isolate the variables approach to let's see what this looks like when you've got a PowerPoint presentation and numbers and this?
I'm not sure that they're mutually exclusive. We still isolate lots of variables. I mean, experimental research is about variables, and it's about controlling variables. So you need to isolate things. You need to make sure, as I said before, that you're measuring what you think you're measuring. And for you to be able to do that, you need to make sure that there's as few confounds as possible. There's as little noise as possible. Hence the white room setup, which is often criticized, particularly in this field, which is so applied and pragmatic. And I yet have to go to a conference where I'm not told, yeah, that's all fine and well, but this is not a speech I would interpret. And I can't have a certain amount of patience, but it is not infinite. It is rather finite these days. So I usually just give the example of you going to your GP for a checkup because you want to run the marathon. He's not going to hook you up to your ECG sensors and have you run a marathon to know whether you can run a marathon. Mm. He's going to, if it's an old-fashioned GP like mine, he'll have a little step stool and he'll say, okay, Killian, you got 60 seconds. Now step up and down as fast and as long as you can. He'll cut me off at 60 seconds and he'll measure my pulse and he'll say, yes, you're good to run, or nah, you better stay home because you're not going to make it through the race. How does stepping up and down a step stool relate to running a marathon? You know, it is a stylized environment in which you try to establish a cause and effect relationship. And we have to acknowledge that. Now it's true that we've branched out as well, and we've attempted to use some naturalistic stimuli. But anytime you do that, you need to up the controls elsewhere.
Hmm. And this kind of moves on to the next question is, you're setting up an experiment. What does a typical experiment look like for you, and what do you take into account when you're trying to design it to work?
Do we design it to work? We designed it to have fun. No, obviously we tried to design it to work. That's one of the prime objectives. You want to get some discrete data. The worst thing is a null result, even though it's not the worst thing. Null results are underrated. It's a pity that we don't get to publish many of the null results. I think other people would be spared a lot of time and effort if null results were published. So, you know, I don't have to do that because it's not going to work. Whereas everybody seems to be led on to make the same mistake. Typical experiment, there is no such thing as a typical experiment, but there are typical steps in any and all experiments. And the kind of stuff, I can really only talk about the kind of stuff we do, really starts with the research question. Which is often motivated by a bit of a gut reaction or a strong reaction, even emotional reaction to something you've heard, to an assumption, to a claim, and you're thinking, baloney, let's test that. Or that's a lot of BS, you know, just general assumptions. Then you hammer out your RQ, your research question, which is not trivial. You look for the method that is best suited to get you data that can answer those questions, and then come the materials. And I can't stress that enough. You don't just go and pick a random speech that was given somewhere and say, okay, those are going to be my materials. My PhD students, perhaps it's me, who's a slave driver, but my PhD students on average spend some 6 months developing stimuli. And a lot of work goes into those because you need to control for things because you're reducing it to such a micro level that any failure at not controlling things will introduce so much so many confounds and so much noise that you're not going to get anything out of there. So and then come the participants, of course.
Yeah, I was going to say, so this has been the $10 million question in the experimental side of interpreting, at least, I guess, field research has not always gotten on any better. How do you find participants and how do you twist their arm to get them to participate?
Well, we're obviously lucky as compared to some places with I think, very, very promising research programs that are situated far away from places where conference interpreters tend to live. It is a bit of a truism that, and we do a lot of research on conference interpreters. And if you broaden that field and say we work on interpreters in general, then you might find many more participants. So we're lucky in that we have some probably 230, 40 AIC members here in Geneva. And that's many of them. Yeah, many of them are very generous in giving their time in participating. Just contributing to furthering our knowledge about what they do. Don't usually need to bribe or to push too hard. And I say don't usually. and so that's how we get the participants. I feel very strongly about one thing, and that is if I want to make claims about professional conference interpreters, I need to test professional conference interpreters. Mm-hmm. You probably know that some 90%, you do know that 78.6% of all statistics are made up on the spot.
On the spot.
And that's this right. Is one of them. So let's just say that 90% of all knowledge we have about the human psyche, about psychology, stems from American BA students, because that's the participants that everybody uses, right? So is that a representative sample and or population? Not sure. If I want to know about interpreting students, I should test interpreting students. If I want to know about professionals, I should test professionals. That is provided I assume there's a difference between the two, which seems to be this trend about professionalization, about expertise, and so on and so forth. So if there's any truth to that, that you're different, I'm very hesitant to use the word, but I mean it in the very basic sense of the term, qualitatively. So if some quality of you is different as a professional than it was when you were in, you know, in interpreting 101, then that's the population we need to.
And this is an interesting one, because I think it was Miriam Schlesinger who pointed out that interpreters tend to be happier when the results of experiments show how wonderful the professionals are, and not so happy when when something else comes out. Have you had? I've met a few researchers who've had issues with research turning up results that the profession didn't like so much. Has that ever been something that's crossed your desk?
Everybody likes to be right, right? Mm-hmm. That's a very human
trait. I can't relate to that at all.
not a day goes by when I'm like, yep, I was right. Good on me. So that's the beauty about experimental research. It gives you relatively little room for spinning. Which other approaches give you much more room for spinning. And, you know, once I'm not saying they're worth less. I'm not saying the results are less valid. I'm not saying the results are less useful. I'm just saying the results are to be looked at differently. You start from, if you have experimental on one end of the spectrum, and then at the very other end of the spectrum, you might have a qualitative setup where you are involved in the thing. You need to make sure that is well described, because you might well introduce a lot of, if not bias, at least variables into that equation. And there are really good examples, pre-pandemic examples. I don't know if they're even talked about anymore at this point, but up until the end of 2019, before this whole online thing became to be our daily bread, there was a lot of talk about the few studies that had looked at remote conference interpreting. And the interesting thing was that anything that had been measured objectively with the physiological measurement of it was the stress measures, it was fatigue measures, and so on and so forth, did not line up with the subjective measurements. So interpreters felt that they were performing more poorly when they worked in remote, but a blind analysis of their output by judges who didn't know which condition they were judging showed that there was no significant difference. They felt that they were more stressed, but cortisol levels, which granted it turned out might not be the best way to measure it, did not indicate any such additional stress, and so on and so forth. So anytime you have that, you need to tread very carefully. It's perhaps too simplistic to say, well, interpreters are just lying to us for reason X, Y, Z, which perhaps had you asked me 15 years ago or 20 years ago, I would have been much more inclined to believe, right? At this stage, having seen what happens elsewhere in research, and also thanks to the work of some of my PhD students, shout out to Laura Keller, relatively recently graduated, got her PhD. Shout out to Rona Amos, who only just defended in the late fall. We know that certain things are just very difficult to measure. So we need to do a double take or a triple take or a quadruple take and admit that we're still at the very beginning of certain types of research into an extraordinarily complex object of study, which is interpreting. It's a little more complex than measuring other things because it's noisy, but it's fun.
And I think that's interpreting use. When I started my PhD, interpreting had a bit of a kind of cognitivist versus contextualist. It was kind of like an academic version of West Side Story, Alex. You get the experimentalists in one corner, and the people who liked to go, the people who liked the research gave them tickets to go to conferences, was it where in the other? And it seems to have become a lot better, because I think, I don't know if you've noticed this, Kellen, there seems to be more of a realization that both sides need each other. And I love what you said about some things are extraordinarily difficult to measure, because in some cases, I'm not even sure if we know what we need to be measuring.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the old, I want to say it's an Einstein quote, not everything that matters can be measured, and that everything you can measure matters. It's sometimes as simple as that. You do need both sides. As you were saying that, the West Side Story analogy, I was thinking of something a little more modern, even though already 15 or 20 years old, but maybe you're almost in the right age bracket. So remember that on MTV, Celebrity Deathmatch, and you could have a celebrity deathmatch of somebody working in experimental and somebody working in qualitative.
Now we're talking my level. Okay. Now I feel at home.
But, I mean, it's kind of like if Take That broke up and then got back together. That's getting to my ear now. But it's this realization of building
happening
up
here.
It's building up a whole picture of what's going on now. This is always a difficult question to ask a researcher, because every researcher wants to name their own work. But what if you were sitting down with practitioners who had never even thought of spelling the word cognition? What are the big findings that you would want them to know about, and that you think they should be even applying to their own work?
I'm not even sure that I would qualify any findings as big findings. That's not usually how it happens. It's finding, research in a lifetime. You keep contributing tiny, tiny little pieces to the puzzle. And anybody who sets out to doing a PhD thinks, I'm going to change the world. I'm going to get this article in Nature. and everybody's going to talk about my stuff for, generations to come, which usually doesn't happen, because you contribute a minute thing about a minute aspect of a minute part of a part of the bigger thing. And that's being optimistic. So I think, the challenge is that it's only by replicating a number of times in experiments, if we look at cognition through the lens of doing experiments, you would eventually get to perhaps make a claim about something that could then be considered a big bit of a game changer. What I'm always happy to share is stuff that is counterintuitive. So you mentioned this before, we all have our convictions, we all have our assumptions, we don't like them being challenged. And that's where I come in. So I love pushing those buttons. Recent example, we studied experimentally what happens during simultaneous interpreting with text. And if you find the average interpreter who does that, and you'll ask them, so how is it done? They will tell you that, it's all about prediction. Interpreters always anticipate. So when we have the text, we can look ahead in the text and we know what's coming. And it's much more important to know what's ahead. Well, we go and measure, and we see that when interpreters read, just to answer questions about a text, they do look ahead. So it's a very natural feature of reading. But at least in this one, and I need to stress this, in this one experiment, only the conditions we set, interpreters did not look ahead. They were lagging behind with their vision, meaning that that information, whilst being attended to, was being attended to for a different purpose. So is that big? No. Is it earth-shattering? No. But it contributes a little bit to our understanding of the process, an even more complex process than just the interpretation of simultaneous, of improvised simultaneous stuff. And ideally, but not necessarily, it might even trickle down into training.
We certainly didn't do any sim with text training in the couple of times that I've had to do it professionally. I've came across this idea that you're getting cognitive overload. It seems to me like sim with text creates a situation where you're going, should I be following the person or the text or what? If there was an eye tracking, I'm sure you've done the eye tracking study to track an interpreter's eyes when they're trying to work out which source of information they should be following, would be hilariously funny, because they'd probably be jumping about the place like kangaroos.
we haven't done experiments down under yet, but I have a good friend, shout out to Mark, Orlando, who keeps insisting I need to swing by. So I'm going to swing by and we'll do the tests, perhaps even on kangaroos, or compare kangaroos with conference interpreters.
I did jokingly write once that all interpreters are goldfish, but that's a whole other joke. Now, one of the things that you became famous for when I was doing my PhD was that in 2010-ish, the world was still in awe of Daniel Gilles. Well, the interpreting world was still in awe of Daniel Gilles' effort models, which is this idea that you break interpreting down into, I think it's four, simultaneous interpreting breaks down into four or five individual efforts. And so you can concentrate more on your analysis of what's going on, or you can concentrate more on your production, or you can concentrate more on understanding the source text. And I can't remember exactly.
I don't understand your use of the past tense. Where are you going with this, Jonathan?
Where I'm going with this is that I happen to remember it was probably around the time I was doing my PhD, probably slightly earlier actually, you began to suggest ever so gently, as you're known for doing, that perhaps the effort models don't stand up to experimental scrutiny. Could you explain the story of how you came to think of challenging the effort models and where you stand with them now?
Now, I know what you're doing here. You're stacking the odds in your favor for this wager that
for
we have
wager,
going.
That's exactly
for the wager,
right.
This is exactly what you do. This is so transparent. So I think
it's listeners working,
need
isn't
to know.
It?
Listeners need to know that there's a wager going. Am I going to offend somebody first, or is Jonathan going to pitch the fact that he's currently working on a particular article on a particular subject right now first? So he's definitely luring
me. He's stacking the odds for sure.
Right. So Daniel Gilles, whom I know also personally, I wouldn't say a close friend, but we know each other relatively well, have had a number of exchanges over the years, and is the author of probably the, if not the most famous, then the second most famous model of the interpreting process, a particular take on it, after the Paris model. Paris model is super simple. You listen, you deverbalize, you speak, and his model is not much more complex. So it's strikingly simple, and it's very well known, and it is also similarly useful for training. I would argue both are very, very useful models for training. Where does it get problematic? In my view, it gets problematic that it's not really a model in the traditional sense. In the traditional Popperian sense of the notion, you have a theory, often represented as a model, that you set out to falsify. It's only a good theory if it can be falsified. If you can say, well, yes, there's the data that suggests it stands up, and conversely, there's data that suggests that no, in fact, that's wrong, and then you can ideally develop a better theory with a better model. So that's how, in my perhaps old-fashioned view of research also in science, that's how you make progress. Now, I was told in those exchanges that no, it's not really a model, even though it's called the model, and it even has a hypothesis attached to it. This tightrope hypothesis, we're not going to get into detail, but it's a conceptual framework which can't be tested. And that's where you lose me if you want to use this as the cornerstone of doing research. Now, the problem is it is so simple that few are the MA students writing a thesis on the subject that can avoid using it, because it's basically A plus B equals C. I'm oversimplifying an already simple model. So I am told, perhaps we'll leave it at that. I suggested a different model, slightly more complex and slightly more, I know it's horrendously complex as compared to what Daniel suggests, and that's where I lose people, and I don't have a large fan base as does Daniel. But that's okay. My model aims at being falsifiable, and we're currently continuing in our efforts to develop just that, experiments to falsify it, because I am not wedded to my model. And if tomorrow I find evidence that suggests that, no, in fact, that's diametrically opposed to the way it should be looking, then I'll just redraw it and have a V2 or B3 and maybe charge people to upgrade. But I have been told, I haven't checked this myself, I have been told, Daniel writes his own blog, that I recently earned an honorable mention in one of his presentations as one of the people who doesn't understand his models. So I beg for his indulgence, and maybe he'll have the patience to run me through it and explain them to me once.
This is the thing. So although I'm a field researcher, so let's explain to those who aren't familiar with different ways of doing science. There's a way of doing science that says you come up with a hypothesis, which is an idea of what will be true. And the aim is to create a hypothesis that you can falsify, which means that you state in advance, if I find this evidence, then I'm wrong. To rapidly, massively oversimplify Karl Popper. Mm-hmm. And even in my qualitative work, I was testing Franz Puhacker's model that he developed during his PhD. And I tried to turn that into a falsifiable model, saying, here's the evidence that would show it to be wrong. You can't really have evidence that proves a theory to be true. That's a whole other issue. But I wrote in my thesis, if I find this, then the model is wrong. It turned out I found the very thing that would tell you that the model was wrong. And Franz was one of my examiners, which was rather fun. But this is where you can have something that's really useful as a tool, but you can never know if it's right.
And I think
that's a problem.
Right, but need it be a problem? Mm. I think it need not be a problem. I think it becomes problematic when you're no longer striving to improve the model, but rather where you've grown so attached to this being your pyramid that you want to leave behind, that you're not going to take kindly to people taking bricks out of that pyramid. And I have a wonderful example of somebody who was on my PhD defense on the Viba many moons ago now. And that is Ted Gibson from MIT. I borrowed, obviously giving credit, his theory very, very, very generously. Only to find out just about the time when I defended, or maybe a couple of months after that, that he said, no, you know what? Actually, no. Nope. I was wrong. I have a better one now. I'm like, no, I haven't even published my stuff. and you're pulling the rug out underneath from me. So, but it need not be an issue. Mm-hmm. Models are there to be replaced by ideally better models. And if the same person can come up with a better model, so much the better. And if another person comes up with a better model, then that should be fine too. Can anybody come up with a simpler model than Daniel's back in the day, Danica Seleskovic's? Probably not, because then we're really bringing it down to, you know, a half a sentence or one word, and that's not much of a model.
And I think that's the thing, is finding the balance between models that really do a good job of describing what's going on and models that you can explain in a few sentences. And as someone who deliberately dances on the boundary between research and practice, that's always a difficult balance to hit, because you want to say something useful, but you don't want to say something inaccurate, and that's difficult. Now, at the last EST conference in South Africa, and I still haven't quite worked out how the European Society of Translation Studies ended up in South Africa. So, I noticed a lot of research coming out from your department and from your group on interpreter cognition in the classroom. I'm used to hearing about interpreter cognition in the experimental unit. Could you explain how you came across those ideas and how that could help teaching?
Right. Well, this is something we've actually been doing, or we've aspired to do in Geneva over a number of years now. It's been traditionally our approach to close the circle and to not only have fundamental research, even though we do fundamental research, but see to which extent we can apply it and re-inject some of those findings into the teaching, for example, because that is the main mission of our MA CI program. So what we've done is we have tried to describe the approach to training or teaching simultaneous interpreting, particularly the introduction to simultaneous, as a very complex task in terms of cognitive ergonomics. So once more, we come back to one of my favorite topics, which is that of cognitive load, which obviously is borrowed from cognitive load theory, which actually originates from learning. How do learning activities need to be designed to minimize the load on the learner so as to maximize the learning outcome? It's strikingly simple, but to do it is not nearly as simple. And so we've tried to connect the dots and dare I use a political metaphor, reach across the aisle, because that's what you do. So we reached across the aisle, but seeing that we have a majority, we still pushed it through.
no, 1.9
trillion.
That's way too close to the bone in the UK right now.
So we reached across the aisle and really tried to bring together different suggestions that are found in the literature from different sides. Those who'd like to train holistically and to look at the interpreting task as a holistic thing, that the even the attempt or the idea of splitting it up into smaller bits is heresy. And the others who say, well, you're out of your mind because you're cooking, you know, basically minestrone with way too many ingredients in there, and we need to take them out to understand them. And all of that in an attempt to improve the efficiency and the effectiveness of these first few weeks of introducing simultaneous or introducing students to simultaneous. And so we play a lot off of what you said before, this whole separation of channels of information provided. When and how is it provided? Visually, is it provided verbally, is it provided as an auditory verbal stimulus, as a visual verbal stimulus, is it static information, is it dynamic information? This is where I actually dress up and we cook in class. I actually make pancakes and I have the chef's head and everything. It's a lot of, you know, both research and training can be a lot of fun. And so that's where the idea comes from. The model has now been, you know, put out very recently with one of my current PhD students, Eleanor Arbona. Shout out to her. Mm-hmm. She does a lot of work on the processing of visual stimuli, gestures and such. But it's in its first iteration, and we are only now designing the experiments to at least partially test some of the assumptions. So the model is there, and now we're going to test the assumptions, and then we're probably going to, you know, chip away at it and change it and modify it. Caution. No, do not apply expecting miraculous results, because for the time being, this is very prototypical.
And I think that's the thing is sometimes you don't know what works until you explore. And also I'm aware of a lot of research in teaching interpreters has historically been based on relatively small numbers. So it must be difficult for an experimentalist like you to go, okay, there's a limitation to the stats I can run on this.
coincidental, but we focus on the introduction to simultaneous, and as you probably know, there are schools that do not front load their training program with consecutive. So in theory, I can devise experiments that use proficient, for whatever that means, bilinguals, and see how I would need to devise certain activities for them to effectively and efficiently acquire an additional skill. So to get them started on this simultaneous interpreting thing. But yes, note that the participants are obviously the N. The infamous N, so the number of participants you get, which has a direct effect on on your effect size is always a crux in interpreting. But we've been improving on that end too. And there are a number of studies now coming out using professionals with, you know, 24 participants. If you do everything else right, 24 participants will give you nice statistics. You don't need to have, you know, the same N as you would in the medical study where you need to test 1,000 people.
Could run a few correlations. Yeah, I could see how that would work. Now, the interesting point is that you talked about closing the circle from research back into classroom training. Is there a place for closing the circle between research and continued development of practitioners? So, for example, finding what you're learning about teaching in the classroom and then using that to develop courses to help, I don't know, upskill or reskill or help practitioners in some way.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly do that through a program we actually run, which is MAS, Masters of Advanced Studies in Interpreter Trainers. I think we're still the only ones who offer a course like that. And you would think, gosh, talk about a niche market. So not only do you know training interpreters is a niche market, but training those who train interpreters and turning that into a full-fledged MA program is even more of a niche than that. But that's an area in which we try to inject lots of findings, this whole atomistic approach of peeling away the layers. But also, you know, the odd AIC workshop that I've been asked to do on stuff like how to best prep for SimText. Well, that's where the findings that came out of the study were immediately transposed to argue for why we would suggest interpreters do one thing and not the other. And it's really neat when they say, well, you know, but this is what we do. And I give them the quiz and say, what do you do? And people traditionally opt for the, and that's great because otherwise it wouldn't work, the wrong answer. And they say, no, we have data on this. In actual fact, this, let me tell you what you do, which is not always a good position to be in, and you need to, hence my reputation of offending people, because yeah, you know, I'm let us say it's actually true, but somebody is an interpreter, a conference interpreter, they're in this at least perceived elitist small group of a few, certainly only a few thousand members of AIC. We can draw the circle wider and say maybe there's some dozens of thousands of professional conference servers in the world. Yeah, you're special. And so you know how you do what you do, right? Because you're special and we all want to be special. And you don't want somebody you know, telling you because they stuffed a few people into a lab that they know better what you do and how you do it than you know it yourself. But that's the quest, right? We need to go beyond simply being told how. I mean, we don't need to. I want to. That's what keeps me. That's what keeps me up at night. Not always only your show. Often, but not always and only.
I think that's the thing, though, is that there seems to be more and more researchers who, like, I was talking to a PhD student today, and I said the word something like, there are more and more researchers today who are happy to poke the bear.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably, I don't know, societal changes, breaking down barriers, you know, things shift. Don't know. Maybe there are more bears around. Maybe they're just more pokeable.
I think also, I've heard of people whose PhD supervisor said, you know, don't rock the boat. My PhD supervisors would send me out looking for boats to rock. It's kind of like... But I think it depends on the environment that you're in, and also it depends on awareness of the big questions. And I like this idea of, you know, interpreters think of themselves as elite, and have someone come around and say, maybe it doesn't look like that. I associate with both sides of that equation. Alex, have you ever been
for sure
made uncomfortable that someone dropped your brain? I don't want you to talk about that.
Yeah, I think that's definitely happened. I think it's definitely what you were saying. Everybody kind of thinks they're special and they know exactly how they're doing it. And you're kind of set in your own ways. And then if somebody comes along and says, hey, actually, I've done some research on this, and I can empirically say this is what we found during that research, and it contradicts what you're thinking, I could definitely see why some people wouldn't be fans of that. But I guess it's just kind of how it goes, right?
Yeah. It's the danger of research. How do you deal with, just before we come to wrap up, how do you deal with the built-in uncertainty in research? So in experiments, you can actually give a number to how certain you are, you know, a percentage or a p-value if you're a connoisseur of statistics. How do you deal with the built-in uncertainty in interpreting research? Because we tend to have a small number of people involved, or just the statistics can never make us 100% certain.
Sorry, as I was listening, I thought to myself, I didn't understand that. Can you repeat that? It's the accent. Sorry, I promised I would squeeze that in.
Wait, is that one of those things that is offensive to someone?
Yeah.
Did you just? Okay, got it.
This is why I'm glad the video does not show on the final recording.
I mean, that's the thing. And that's perhaps why of late there's been more convergence among the different approaches. You can obviously go nuclear with the statistics, and these days statistics look intimidatingly nuclear, even to me, as compared to what I still got away with, you know, doing my PhD. A little ANOVA was perfectly fine, and now you have very complex models. There's also very good software out there allowing you to do that, but you need to live with this idea of your claim, particularly if you do inferential statistics. So if you're trying to extrapolate what you found on a small sample to how this would apply to the population, or your population, not the general population, so the population of interpreters at large, and from that perspective, it makes sense that experiments only look at such small microscopic parts of the whole thing. And that's the only thing you can make a relatively modest claim about. But again, brings us back to Popper. If you find repeatedly, ideally, that something is not the case, well, then you can claim it's not the case. It must be something else. Right? You cannot claim that something's always going to be like this. You can claim that something has not always been like this, or is not always like that. And so it's an extraordinary, it's the long game that you play when you do research, much to the frustration of practitioners, because they would like to have all the answers after one experiment that ideally can be put together, run, and published in 4 months and doesn't cost anything.
Thank you. You've just described the entirety of why I don't like research. I'm just like, God, this all sounds so tedious and long.
Yeah.
It reminds me of Geneva when we had that wonderful town hall, and we asked people, the practitioners, what would they like from research? And a couple of the answers were basically, prove us right.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, that's a really, I would love to be proved right. But I've seen too much research to realize how dangerous a game that is.
And I think that's the great privilege one has when you work for an academic institution. You have academic freedom. Nobody can put any sort of pressure on you for your results to go either way. And that people know. And I'm very pleased that people still come to us and say, you know, we want you to run this. Research can't be run by the association that will then use the results for a political argument or negotiations. It's just not on. You know, if you want to know if smoking is healthy, I'm not sure I'm going to buy into the results that Philip Morris, you know, just sponsored. Monsanto tells us that genetically modified corn is the greatest thing on earth. And Rio Tinto tells us that we need to keep digging because it's wonderful for the planet. Okay, you see where I'm coming from. So I think that is one of the biggest privileges of being able to do this job, you know, being a professional researcher, even though, and that's, yeah, the sad note on which I'm going to end. The longer you stay in academia, the more admin you end up having to do, the more, you know, management responsibilities you get, and the less research can do. I think it's definitely true that you'll do the last stint of proper untarnished research where you can dedicate all the time in the world to it is going to be your postdoc. So once you're on your own, you know, you've graduated, you can fly, and then you have a year or two or three to do your stuff. And after that, yeah, they're going to take that away from you.
That is a very sad note to end on. They clipped your wings.
But you do it partially by proxy. And that's why you have a team. Mm. And I've been extraordinarily lucky to have a wonderful team, which, you know, rejuvenates, and you get new PhD students. We have small teams in our different labs, no more than three, maybe four PhD students. And they partly carry the torch slightly differently in a slightly different direction. But they do carry it. And in many respects, they do a much better job than I could have or would have. So that too is part of the game. And don't build pyramids.
We love to end the show on kind of big ideas and big thinking. If there's one idea that you would like, you know, a practitioner who's never read research before, take away from this podcast episode, what would it be?
Does this have to be a one-liner?
Take your time.
We have a very good editor, so.
What would it be? In my experience, ordinarily, interpreters are exceptional, but they're also exceptionally ordinary. To mean that they, in many ways, interpreters behave very similarly to quote-unquote naive participants. Your average Jane or your average Joe. In some, they don't, but in many respects, they do. So, asking interpreters how they feel about a particular thing in interpreting is good, but it's not good enough. It's good for certain things, and it shouldn't be discarded. But you need to go beyond that. And then there are examples with the study on prolonged turns where interpreters were told you keep going beyond the 30 minutes as long as you think you're providing good quality. And many of them did. And quality went down the drain. Now, the reasons might be debatable. Perhaps it's because we have been conditioned to only be able to do 30 minutes for so and so many years. That's always my quip to those findings. But what's much more important is that the interpreters were not aware. And it goes along the lines of unrecognized sleep loss, where if you sleep less than 6 hours for, I think, 2 weeks, you really start underperforming, as in it's as though you were drunk. And I'm sure that you can relate to that feeling. Mm-hmm. So,
the lack of sleep, not the drunk.
But you don't, I was going to say both of them for sure.
But you don't notice. So you yourself don't notice. And that's why we need research. That's what it's out there for. And those results will hopefully then feed into the well-being thing. Because, that's what those... I don't want to call them hard findings, but at least more informed findings can be used for. But I do have a quote that comes to mind, completely unrelated. I'm not going to research, but it was Spock who said at some point. Remember Spock,
the guy
from Kirk and Spock
and Bones. After years.
That's right, and he said at some point. Something like logic is the beginning of wisdom, not the end. And a bit along the lines of that quote, I think experiments might well be the beginning of some wisdom, but they're certainly not the end.
That is a great way to sign off, Killian. Thank you very much.
Thank you.